Welcome back, everyone. Good to see you. For the last couple of weeks, those of you who've been following our calendar, we've been reading Haftarot. Haftarot are, you know, in Boston you say half Torah, half Torah. So people say, well, it must be half the Torah you're reading. That's not correct. Haftarot were prophetic readings, and we're reading the third one tomorrow. And they're called the three Haftarot of admonition. I'm sure we've been talking about those a bit. Tomorrow, the last one, is the admonition of Isaiah. It's called Chazon Yeshayahu. And tomorrow is, well, this, starting tonight, we have what is called Shabbat Chazon. Chazon, the Sabbath of Vision. We'll talk a bit about that. The Sabbath of Vision sort of overtakes the Parsha, which is Devarim, the beginning of the book of Deuteronomy, where Moses begins his oration and his version of what took place over the years before. And it's a fascinating book because of what agrees with what happened before, what Moses remembers, where Moses starts, etc., etc. Example, Moses starts his talk not in Egypt, talking about that, but he starts his talk about Sinai, basically saying that this is really the starting point of the Jewish people, or the Israelites, is Sinai, and not necessarily only the leaving of Egypt, because of the generation that he's now talking to, who left Egypt, are no longer alive. So Shabbat Chazon, the Chazon of Yeshayahu, Isaiah. Isaiah lived probably in the 8th and 9th century before the Common Era in the Kingdom of Israel, which is the Northern Kingdom, which was taken over by the Assyrians in 722 BCE. But that's not important, but it's good to know for the midterm. So what are the what is being asked of us according to this admonition? It's constantly, and Isaiah is always doing this. Isaiah is always reminding us of the fact that we are living in a possibility of opening up to moral decay. He is constantly doing that. He interrupts Yom Kippur by saying, you know, who needs this fast? You, as a society, you are failing the most marginal. And that's what really is this admonition. The admonition is that if one does not repair one's ways, devastation will follow. So remember, these are not these are descriptive and not prescriptive. They don't have to happen. So they're not prophecies in that sense, that this is going to happen, but it doesn't have to happen. And that's the role of the prophet. The prophet wants to see his prophecy fail, and that would be a success. It's sort of a little non-intuitive, but that's the way it is. So there's a call for forgiveness, there's a call for all kinds of things. And there are very famous lines in Chazon Yeshayahu, the vision of Isaiah. One is this famous one where God says, "Come now, let us reason together. Though your sins are like scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. Though they are red like crimson, they shall be like wool." Talks about Yerushalayim, how the faithful city has become a harlot. She that was full of justice, righteousness, lodged in her, now murderers. And then a vision of the redemption of Zion will be redeemed with justice, and its returnees with righteousness. So basically there's this constant theme we have. There's also another thing that unites this week, it's, by the way, Devarim is always the Parsha read before Tisha B'Av, which is going to happen on Wednesday night of this coming week. It's always the same one, because, and they play with it. You know, there was actually a word in this week's parsha called, the word is Echa. Echa means how, right? How. And Moses, in this context of Devarim, says, how can I bear these people? He's not reaching the point again. How can I bear these people? But then you also have in Chazon Yeshayahu the word Echa, meaning where are we going? And then, of course, it's the first word of Echa, of the lamentations we read on Tisha B'Av, Echa. So they play with the fact that all of these three things are happening in this week, so it's all connected. But those of you who are familiar with the ninth of Av is become a symbolic, if you will, time of mourning. It follows these 3 weeks of mourning, and it basically culminates in our basically letting it out in sorrow for the destruction of the temple. And again, there are many different interpretations, and over the years, people have Kanina Hara added every calamity of the Jewish people to Tisha B'Av. Kanina Hara, we have a lot of calamities. So, you know, the first boat leaving of people who are expelled from Spain leave when? On Tisha B'Av, right? And all of these are put in this. And look, we have enough calamity. We could have taken, we could have had 40, 50 fast days. I'm glad they sort of put it only in one. It's okay. It's a 25-hour fast. The only other one is Yom Kippur. It is a time when one basically exhibits mourning by not wearing leather shoes, as you would be in a house of mourning after a death, sitting on the ground, which mourners that today is also do, sit low to the ground. And Tisha B'Av becomes, if you will, this moment of great despair. And of course, I'll in a moment show you how this can be understood in a wider context. Chazon means vision. So this is the vision of Isaiah, the vision of pretty much the destruction. But what else could it mean? So, of course, thank God our mystics and our others have always tried to go to a deeper meaning beyond the text. And one of them is that it is a Shabbat when all of us become visionaries. About what? We envision the third temple. Okay, there's the first temple, the second temple, and there will be a third temple. But this third temple is connected with the Messianic, with the Messianic. And it'll give you a wonderful fable about that, a moment, if you will, by Levi Yitzchak Abadichev. But it's This third temple is, you will see, not constructed by human beings. That's the difference between it. So the temple, it becomes tied in with the Messiah. And then, of course, in order to mitigate to Tisha B'Av, we also have the very, very important tradition that Messiah was born on the afternoon of Tisha B'Av. So you have from the ashes to the phoenix rising again. On the Tisha B'Av. So, again, that's the wonder thing about Jewish teaching. It's totally able to carry more than one idea in its head at the same time, which a lot of people find very confusing. People who want a black and white tradition are not going to find it in Judaism. It's constantly draying around and trying to find ways around stuff. And if you want black and white, you're going to have to basically live in the closet or whatever you want to do, but it's not going to be happening within the Jewish tradition, black and white. So this day of Tisha B'Av is the breaking down of all of our structures. The temple is destroyed. There's no longer this unifying central institution, and where we find God will no longer be within that structure. We're going to find God elsewhere. And it's not ironic, but it's kind of interesting that 6 days after Tisha B'Av, the ninth of Av, we get a holiday which people don't know a lot about called the 15th of Av, Tu B'Av, which is sort of an ancient Valentine's Day kind of holiday where the young people would go out to the fields and they would dance and the people would make dates for the year. You know, it was a social thing, and people would choose wives, and this happened only one other day of the year, and that was, believe it or not, on the afternoon of Yom Kippur. Because remember, they had afternoons free. The services weren't 5 hours long. You know, everything happened in the morning. The Kohen Gadol did most of the service. You said Amen, and you went on your way. So these two dates are times when we get this idea of reacquainting ourselves or falling in love outside of the structures. We meet God in the field, it says, on the Mount of Elul. And Elul, Anila Dodiva Dodili. Elul is made for this reconstruction of the love between the people and God. And then only then, after then, do we say, okay, we'll have you, God, for another year. And we coronate God. That's what Rosh Hashanah is about, right? We say, okay, after all is said and done, we still love each other. So see if this will be a better year. a Shana Tova, a year of good changes for us. Okay, so that's the basic structure of it. But as for the visionary thing, I wanted to spend a little time with that and get some of your visions about that. The word chazon itself means a vision. The modern Hebrew word machazeh, a play, comes from that word, chazon. There's a very interesting and beautiful little teaching from Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev. Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev was one of the close students of the Magid of Mezrich, who was the colleague student of the Baal Shem Tov. And Levi Yitzchak is well known for a number of things, but predominantly he's known because he's called the Ohev Yisrael, the great lover of Israel. And you may know there's a famous Yiddish song called the Din Torah Mit Gott. Levi Yitzchak brings God to trial. You know, and he says, okay, okay, we're trying to keep our side of the deal, but you're not keeping your side of the deal. Basically, all of these horrible things are happening to us. But he was also a great lover of, he was a great lover of Israel. He's always willing to defend Israel. And he is really seen very well as an ultimate kind of Chassidish Rebbe. So he taught a very interesting thing. He says, on Shabbat Chazon, every Jewish soul is shown a vision of the third temple. This subconscious vision acts as a divine comfort before the fast, providing the hope and spiritual strength necessary to endure the darkness of Tisha B'Av and to work towards redemption. So he sends, very classic idea, God sends the medicine before the illness. So we have this vision that helps us through despair, gives us a glimmer of hope. But there's a deeper significance as well. And he gives this following metaphor. A father once prepared a beautiful suit of clothes for his son, but the child neglected his father's gift, and soon the suit was in tatters. The father gave the child a second suit of clothes, and this one too was ruined by the child's carelessness. So the father made a third suit, and this time, however, he withholds it from his son. Every once in a while, on special and opportune times, he shows the suit to the child, explaining that when the child learns to appreciate and properly care for the gift, it will be given to him. And this induces the child to improve his behavior until it gradually becomes second nature to him, at which time he'll be worthy of his father's gift. It's a lovely idea. It basically talks to us about the fact that the world is diffused, if you will, with this capacity to be careless and to receive gifts and not take them very seriously. So too, what's going to happen, the vision will be the vision of the fact that the third temple, which will be created by God, and according to another source, and it will be dropped down from heaven, beherif ayin, in the twinkle of an eye, and it will be there ready, no longer needing our particular physical work as the other two temples had before it. So this is this liminal moment. Again, this is where a lot of wonderful things happen in life, is in between, in the Zwischenzeit, it's called in German, in the in-between, in the that moments that are about to end but have not yet begun. And this is what Tisha B'Av certainly is. It's a liminal moment between destruction and then right away within it, reconstruction. So you have deconstruction, reconstruction happening pretty much at the same time. Just a few more things, and then we'll turn to visioning in general. Later on, by the way, people take the clothes metaphor very seriously, and they say, well, you know what? It's interesting what clothes are. What are clothes? Clothes are garments. They're structures within which we live, right? But what's different about clothing and that's other things is that clothing becomes totally personalized. Your suit fits you based on your physique, and suit will fit somebody else by their physique, and you'll get used to it. You'll know what size to buy after a while, which fits you, and you can't buy a one-size-all suit. And that personalization shows that even when you have the suit, etc., you still have to have that personal buy-in. It's not a, you say, the vision of all the people. Yes, but ultimately every individual has to have his own buy-in. And each individual takes this vision, if you will, takes this vision to inspire them and to enlighten them. So there's a lot more to say, but I won't do one more except somebody, so I was, looking around and seeing, is this idea of prophecies of doom, are they found in other traditions? And then, Dankengott, it's found everywhere. I know people have asked me about, since I've had this, this little Jubu thing going. So he says, tell me what's happened to Buddhism. So Buddhism has prophecies of doom, but they differ from the Western apocalyptic ideas. They describe a massive cyclical decline of human morals, the loss of Buddhist teachings, and the eventual cosmic destruction following by the rise of a new world. And they're found in a number of sutras. I'm not an expert, but they're there in different sutras. There's one called the Sutra of the Total Extinction of the Dharma. Wow, that's a pretty heavy-duty one. And then there's the one about the end of the world in the Kakavati Shanada Sutra. And there's also one and a few others that basically are like the Shambhala prophecy, right? The idea there was a king, a King Shambhala will emerge after everything is lost. And rather than bringing the permanent end of humanity, the battle of Shambhala and the forces of destruction, that the battle will usher in a new enlightened golden age. And there's even, a tradition of a future Buddha. A Buddha of the future that would transcend the Buddha that we have, and that is called Maitreya, return to teach a dharma of peace, etc., etc. It's not exactly the same, but it's fascinating that even in this tradition that basically, talks about only, being aware of our own breath and ourselves and all that, really has a sense of a cosmic kind of possibility of destruction, which can be, again, not prescriptive, but descriptive, right? This seeing the way we are, not saying this is the way it always has to be. So I'm going to stop now and just open up a little bit about visions. Now, if you have too many visions, people want to put you away. But what does it mean to have a vision? And I'd like to see if we can see how that plays a role in our practice as well. Because I think when we sit quietly, one of the things that does happen is we get visions. And these visions, are passing. It's true, we let them pass, but they're there, and they're coming from somewhere deep within. And I wonder where these visions come from. And I know that they do pass, but they come back again. And so let's have a visitation about visionaries. Anyone like to open up? Yes, Beryl, please.